Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarin.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. It's been 3 days since a shooter tried to assassinate former President Trump at a rally in Butler, Pennsylvania. Investigators are still combing through the evidence, trying to understand the shooter's motives and any security lapses that allowed such a close call with a presidential candidate. And many Americans are also trying to make sense of what happened. How could something like this happen? And many are blaming the state of our politics, how polarized and toxic they've become.
There is so much hyperbole, anger, violent language. This election is portrayed as the most consequential in our history, the stakes higher than ever, so everything feels heightened and intense. However, in the last few days, there's been at least an attempt to calm things down.
We can have heated political discourse and debates, but it shouldn't be personal and we shouldn't be targeting people. I mean, look, President Biden himself said in recent days it's time to put a bullseye on Trump. I mean, I know that he didn't mean what is being implied there, but that kind of language on either side should be called out.
Some of the extreme rhetoric we see contributed to the attempt on President Trump, and this is unacceptable in American political life, and we need to come together and agree on that.
Saturday, the devil came to Pennsylvania holding a rifle, but an American lion got back up on his feet and he roared!
Now that was Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson, Pennsylvania Republican Senate candidate Dave McCormick, and South Carolina Senator Tim Scott. He was speaking last night at the Republican National Convention. And this hour, we are wondering, how are you feeling right now, days after the assassination attempt? What do you think is wrong with our politics? And how can we bring the country back together? Call us or email us. Our number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
Now, we're going to be joined momentarily by Princeton University's Eddie Glaude Jr. and Republican consultant Christopher Nicholas for a conversation on that topic. But first, before we get there, we want to check in at the National Republican Convention in Milwaukee on the start of the second day. You probably know former President Trump arrived last night to a roaring crowd, and yesterday he announced his vice president pick, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance. Joining us now from the convention is WHYY political reporter Carmen Russell Sluchansky. Carmen, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you very much for having me. Good afternoon.
Yes, so Carmen, we're going to start with the big announcement. J.D. Vance, senator from Ohio, first learned about him via his film about his life, Hillbilly Elegy. Tell us a little bit about his background and why you think he's the pick.
Yeah, well, you know, he's had quite a meteoric rise since he published that book that you mentioned. And I remember very clearly that when that book came out, a lot of people rushed to read it because the book helped to explain, or at least people believe that it helped to explain the rise in Donald Trump's popularity in areas like Rust Belt, Ohio, where J.D. Vance was from. And I think that actually goes to a lot of his his appeal. And when I talked to delegates, when I talked to Pennsylvania delegates here, after he was announced and after he actually showed up on the floor yesterday, they said that he really exemplifies the American dream, having come from virtually nothing, you know, going to Yale Law School, then becoming a businessman and now a sitting United States senator and now the VP nominee for a major party.
Yeah, to that point, I want to bring in a cut from a Pennsylvania Republican delegate and former Congressman Fred Keller talking about J.D. Vance as the VP pick. Let's hear that audio.
I think it's really a great pick. I think President Trump, as always, does all the research and homework that needs to be done. To have a partner, to have somebody that will make sure we're not forgotten and represent us well, not just in America, but around the globe.
All right. So any pushback on the Vance pick that you're hearing there at the convention, Carmen, or is it just unanimous praise?
It's virtually unanimous praise. I didn't really hear anyone say anything negative about J.D. Vance, among the very large Republican crowd that's here. Now, you know, some of that's going to be a little bit by design, right? Like they're not going to criticize Trump's brand new VP. And it is interesting because, you know, it doesn't serve. Actually, one comment I got was that you know, kind of, I have to say this was like background, but like somebody said, well, it doesn't serve us very much in the sense that he's from very red Ohio, right? Mm-hmm. But I wonder, this is the kind of the thinking, considering, you know, Ohio and Pennsylvania are very similar situated, I do kind of wonder, you know, how it might affect Pennsylvania voters. You know, obviously we have our own kind of Rust Belt areas here as well.
The same for Michigan and Wisconsin, I would assume. Yeah.
Yeah. And I want you to talk a little bit about J.D. Vance a little more, because I remember he was a Trump hater. I mean, he was staunchly against the former president, and now he is going to be his lieutenant and biggest ally in this race. Can you talk about his 180 degree turnaround a little bit?
Yeah, so he had very harsh words to say for Donald Trump back in, you know, 2016 and beyond. And he was very surprised that Donald Trump won the general election and called him America's Hitler and cultural heroin and a bunch of other things. So what happened was is that J.D. Vance actually decided he wanted to run for Senate. And this was in 2022. And, you know, he was thinking that he probably couldn't win without Trump's endorsement. So he went to talk to Donald Trump and basically apologized and then said it was, you know, I'm sorry. I guess I was listening to too much liberal media, the mainstream media that painted you so poorly. And I was wrong. And then Trump watched J.D.'s campaign, watched Vance's campaign, and then eventually came in and helped him out a little.
And now he's the VP pick.
And I want to ask about what else you saw night one, Carmen, that stood out to you. You know, one thing that stood out to me was hearing a speech from Teamsters President Sean O'Brien. Not often you see a fiery speech at the RNC from a major labor leader. Did that stand out to you? Anything else from the round of speeches night one that felt significant for you?
Yeah, I mean that's a really good one that you bring up. They're having daily themes every day, right? And yesterday's was Make America Wealthy Again. So they're really trying to push that kind of economic narrative. I think much of it, you know, did fall, along those lines where they're, you know, not really presenting so much economic plans, but really talking about inflation and the problems that they see as everyday Americans having, you know, the price of groceries and so forth. And certainly having Sean O'Brien there kind of helps say it's like, you know, everyday working Americans are having a hard time under Biden's economy. So there's that. Obviously, they also had a number of, they tried to make the lineup fairly diverse yesterday. And I think that's an effort to try to start courting the black vote around the country, especially in places like Pennsylvania, where we're seeing that Joe Biden is losing a lot of that support. So that was another thing that stuck out to me a lot.
Yeah, and I got to say, I watched a couple of hours of the RNC last night, and I saw at least five black male speakers. Amber Rose, who's from South Philly, also spoke as well. But I want you to talk about the overall messaging. You talked about this Make America Wealthy Again. But do you think the Republican speakers, you know, in light of what happened Saturday, sort of tamped down the messaging and it made it a little less bombastic, as it has been before? Do you feel like they calmed it a little bit? Did you get that vibe?
That's a really good question, because yes, I would say, you know, I hadn't even thought about putting in exactly those words, but I think that's exactly what happened. They did. And I think part of that, you know, was again by strategy. Donald Trump it's reported that Donald Trump plans on giving kind of a unity speech. We'll see how similar it is to Joe Biden's unity speech. But here, I think the thing is that they're also kind of writing, how do I say this? Like, it's actually been a pretty good week for Donald Trump. He's definitely getting some, despite the tragic events on Saturday, this is becoming seen as a positive among some of these, among Republicans, because he really reacted in a way that they say make him proud, you know, and there's these incredible photos of him with his fist raised in the, you know, surrounded by Secret Service, and there's an American flag in the background and so forth. And then so that coupled, you know, that alongside with the recent dropping of the charges in the documents case and so forth, he's actually, there's been a lot of pluses in this. Usually actually see a bump after a convention anyway, but I think the Republicans are basically having a pretty good week.
Yeah.
And before we get you out of here, Carmen, real quick, what are we looking for today at the RNC? What's the highlight of the schedule?
Right. So we have Making America Safe Again. And basically, this is another, you know, long running theme among Republicans that we've been reporting on for a while. They're saying that basically under Joe Biden, that the U.S. has become less safe. They're talking about the rate of crime, rates of gun violence, the epidemic of drug overdoses and those kinds of things. So we're going to see a lot about that. And honestly, it won't surprise me if they talk about Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and so forth. Mm-hmm. What they'll call democratic cities.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is Carmen Russell Sluchansky on the ground in Milwaukee. Carmen, thanks for your insights.
Thank you. It was great. Appreciate it.
Yeah. And coming up, we're turning to the state of our politics, and we are asking you, how do you think we can bring the country back together? You can email studio2@whyy.org or call 888-477-9499. We hope you give us a call. We hope you weigh in. We want to hear what you think. We'll be right back. This is Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. After years of discord and anger, there is once again talk of unity in American politics. The attempted assassination in Butler, Pennsylvania, led to some partisan rhetoric, yes, but also bipartisan calls for calm. We heard earlier from Republican lawmakers, leading Democrats have struck a similar tone.
A former president was shot. An American citizen killed while simply exercising his freedom to support the candidate of his choosing. We cannot go down this road in America.
We need to take down the temperature and rise above the hateful rhetoric that exists and search for a better, brighter future for this nation.
We're all aware of the history over the last few years, including sadly this weekend, of what has been going on with domestic terrorism, what has been going on with political violence, and we are mindful of all of that.
You heard there from President Joe Biden, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, and Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner. And I'll quote again from the president, "We cannot go down this road in America." And I think the question today is, can we get off that road? More specifically, how do we bring the country together? We want to hear from you. Maybe you've got an idea. And maybe you think that question is off base entirely. We're getting some of those emails right now. Let us know. That's our question this hour. How do we bring the country together? Email us studio2@whyy.org. Call us 888-477-9499.
And while you're thinking about that question, dialing your phone or emailing us, let me introduce the guest who will help us sort through this political moment. We have Eddie Glaude Jr., the James S. McDonnell Distinguished Professor at Princeton University and author of We Are the Leaders We Have Been Looking For. We also have Christopher Nicholas, longtime GOP consultant and author of the Pennsylvania Political Digest newsletter. Eddie and Christopher, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you again, friends. You can call us 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. The question is, how do we bring the country together?
Let me start with you, Christopher Nicholas. And just get your reaction in the 24 hours after the events in Butler, Pennsylvania. What went through your mind? And I know you've written a bit about it already. You know, what was your sort of gut reaction?
Beyond the terribleness of the tragedy, obviously, and thank goodness that we only had one death and two serious injuries. And, of course, President Trump escaping relatively unscathed. What hit me was This is now the third hard reset of our presidential race in just 6 weeks. First, we had Trump's guilty verdicts in the trial in New York City. Then we had Biden's terribly unsettling debate performance. And now this attempted assassination in Western Pennsylvania. This has all happened in 6 weeks, which is just incredible. So as I wrote today in my newsletter, I said, are we all just a little bit shell-shocked? You know, are we all a little bit punch drunk from all of this happening so quickly? And I think we are. So let's hope everyone tones it down, not just for a bit, for the duration, but for the duration of the campaign.
And Eddie Glaude Jr., can I get your same reaction in those first 24 hours?
You know, I think more than anything, it was, you know, a sense of the depth of the divide, that we had been on this road of political violence, that it would inevitably evidence itself at this level. I think Chris's point is very interesting, that the chaos is overwhelming. And one wonders, at least I did, whether or not the country was just coming apart at the seams. But there was a sense in which I wanted to, that I reached for trying to understand the previous events that set the stage for something like this to happen. Yeah.
Yeah. And that leads, I want to play this clip. This is a comment from Pastor Todd Johnson of the First Emmanuel Baptist Church. He actually gave the opening remarks at the Trump rally that took place here in Philadelphia. Take a listen.
This country is at a civil divide in terms of our ideology, and that we need to ratchet down on the rhetoric, and we need to lower the temperature on some of the vitriol.
And Eddie, you sort of talked about this a little bit, but I want to ask the question, like, how do we get here where you have a young man who would try to take a shot at a former president in public and killed and injured other people? How did we get here?
You know, I think that's a complex question, and it requires a kind of complex and nuanced answer. The young man was not exempt from the epidemic of loneliness. The deep inequality that informs the grievance that drives much of our politics, the cultural divisions, the cultural wars that we've been engaged in over the last few decades, there's a sense in which we've all kind of retreated into our silos, and those silos have their own individual information ecosystems where our prejudices are confirmed. And the people who disagree with us are viewed as enemies and held with contempt. So this is not just simply a result of the current election cycle, or it's not a result of Trump's presidency. This was unleashed earlier on in our modern political history. So we could tell a story from 1980 to now that has produced this outcome. But I think it's important for us to understand that the very nature of what it means to be citizens joined together in the amazing responsibility of self-governance, that has been undermined over the last few years. Now, that sounds a bit abstract, but to bring it down to the ground, it has been undermined by callous appeals to grievance and hatred, rejections of the idea that ours can be a multiracial democracy, and how selfish, self-interested people have exploited those feelings for their own ends and purposes. So if we're going to tell the truth about how we got here, we're going to have to look at the ugliness of who we are and what and how we and how we've been behaving over the last few decades.
Our listeners have identified many possible sources of this, and I want to read in one comment here from Maura in Delaware County, who says, I don't believe our democracy is headed in a good direction, not just the presidency, but all political figures over the past 8 to 10 years really feel like they stopped caring about the American people, about the systems that will make our country and our people thrive, and really started caring more about themselves, their power, their popularity. They aren't celebrities. They're supposed to work for us. That's Mora's view. We have a caller on the line. This is Michael, who also believes politicians carry a great deal of the blame here, if I'm understanding Michael's setup correctly. Michael, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is, I believe the politicians today moving forward, all of them for election, need to stop pointing the finger at their opponents in regards to what they've done wrong and tell us their plan on what they're going to do and how they're going to fix what's wrong today and make America great again.
Thank you, Michael, for that comment. I want to kick this back over to Christopher Nicholas now. Because you work with politicians, you've consulted, you understand strategy. Has there been a change in the way politicians approach campaigns and their messaging that has become either more negative or more celebrity attention focused?
Well, there is less attention now on persuasion and more attention on motivating your own people.
Mm-hmm.
As I was writing my newsletter, PA Political Digest, yesterday, I had to watch the language I was using because there's naturally a lot of overlap between political terms and terms of war.
Yep.
We're going into battle. We have opponents and enemies. And at one point, I wrote how the Trump's selection of J.D. Vance would provide Democrats with a lot of ammunition to use against him. And I thought, geez, I don't want to use the word ammunition these days. It's kind of a throwaway line in times past, but not anymore. So it's always easier for a politician of any stripe to point out what they see as the problem rather than talking a lot more about the solution, because solutions involve making people change. And let's face it, oftentimes people are very reluctant to change. They think everything else can change and a problem can get better and they can be unscathed by the change. So politicians get that, right? So that's why some of their language oftentimes, regardless of party, veers into spending a lot more time identifying the problem than proposing solutions.
Which suggests to me that the way politicians act is a mirror on how we behave and how we act as much as it is them sort of – it's the chicken and the egg thing, right, Jerry?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why and that's why we're asking you listeners this question today. How do we bring the country together? We have our experts. We have our phone lines open. We have our email open. The number, again, is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. By the way, we have a little bit of news. Our news partner, 6ABC, is noting that David Dutch, he was shot in the chest and liver at that Trump rally last weekend and had been in a medically induced coma. He's now out of this coma and is in stable condition. That just came from our news partner, 6ABC. So that is a bit of good news for David Dutch. And so I want to bring in another caller. We have Dan, who wants to talk solutions here about possibly national service. Dan, you are on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. Yeah, I have a comment about a possible solution. I mean, it was said that it's a super complex problem, which it is. But underlying all of it, I think, is the fact that we have grown up in our own bubbles now. And having something like a National Year of Service would go a long way, I think, to fostering empathy amongst the population, getting us to experience people who aren't like ourselves. And it can solve multiple problems. I mean, we can couple it with college tuition, for example, you know, tuition forgiveness. So it's something that could solve a bunch of problems and help us to, you know, experience people that aren't like ourselves.
Yeah, I like the talk about solutions. I like the thought about that. But I also want to just sort of throw in here, we're still in the middle of a campaign. And I think Chris talked about the fact that we need that. You know, even writing your newsletter, you had to change the language that we're using. That's part of the solution as well. And so I got to ask you both sort of like, how do we have an honest conversation about the threats to democracy that and all the things that are at stake during this election without using the type of language, right, that would continue or up the ante when it comes to violence during this political campaign? And Eddie, I'll throw it out to you first.
Well, I think that's a really important question, because there are folks who believe that this election is existential. They hold the view that if Democrats win, for example, or if Republicans win, that the country as they know it will be lost. And so they bring passions to the political process and to the political debate. So what does it mean if someone makes the claim that Project 2025 is at the heart of a Trump agenda? What does it mean for women if someone is arguing for a national abortion ban? What does it mean for those who hold a certain understanding of the country and the ways in which immigration is being described, or voting is being assaulted, and or LGBTQ plus? So it takes on this existential kind of quality. So we keep thinking, and I think this is really important to say, some of us are treating Donald Trump and others as rational political actors, as somehow typical opponents in a political process that we could account for over the history of American presidential campaigns. There is nothing about Donald Trump, in my view, and I'm not trying to escalate the rhetoric, I'm just trying to tell the truth. There's nothing about Donald Trump that would lead me to treat him as a rational political actor in this moment, given what he and his folk have been doing over the last 5 years, 6 years. And so I think it's really important, as we talk about turning down the temperature, that we don't stop telling the truth. And I think that's really, really important.
And I. Lorenzen emails us and agrees with you, I think, largely, Eddie Glaude Jr., and kind of rejects the premise, I think, of this whole conversation. This email says, "Bring the country together. Give me a break. Who has incited more violence than Trump? Who made fun of Pelosi's elderly husband when he got his head bashed in? Who told his supporters to go to the Capitol and fight? Every single time Trump opens his mouth, he incites ugliness." Mm-hmm. Let me bring you back in the conversation, Christopher Nicholas, because I do think for a lot of folks left of center, it is really, really hard to even entertain this question that we've put out before the listeners today, after January 6th specifically, yeah, that they see that as like a breaking point, that there is really no way to kind of, like Eddie said, treat this like a normal political debate. What do you say to that?
Well, I would point out what Trump himself has said. Since the shooting, he had said before that his speech as written prior to Saturday was a real humdinger, and now it has been rewritten to talk more about national unity. So I would say let's wait and see what he says on Thursday. Tonight, our general speech is at the convention, including Nikki Haley. Tomorrow, the vice presidential designee, J.D. Vance, would be set to give his speech. And then Thursday is Trump. So let's see what they say. Let's give them the benefit of the doubt. That's one of the issues in this never-ending race to the bottom, is when people do perhaps try to break free from what they've been saying before, they are met with mockery and criticism.
So or cries of hypocrisy, as you've mentioned before. You flip-flopped. You said this in the past, and now you want me to believe you're a unifier.
Exactly. So let's wait and see. Both sides have been guilty of using incendiary language. I think President Biden apologized in an interview yesterday with NBC News for his phrasing a couple days before the horrific shooting, of saying that now it was time to put Trump in the bullseye. And that, again, is an example of what I use, what I say when politics just naturally gloms on to a lot of military type language.
And I want to, Chris, I want to push a little bit, because there is no proof that this shooter was incited by anything Democrats said. He could have, we don't know what his motivations were at all. He could have been hearing voices. We don't know, right? And I say this in a sense, are we overreacting, or at least jumping the gun and thinking that it was the Democratic strategy for attacking Trump that led to this shooting? I mean, is it fair? And I say this because VP nominee J.D. Vance posted on social media blaming language that President Biden used in his campaign against the former president as, you know, one of the reasons why this happened. Have we jumped the gun? And is it disingenuous to sort of say and blame Democrats for this?
I don't see any evidence that anyone is to blame for this besides the young man himself. When you read stories now, a couple days past the incident, you kind of see a trend of rising exasperation with our law enforcement folks, because they have not yet found anything that leads them to say, oh, this is why he did it. I think in today's day and age, we all think that every person who does this somewhere in their, you know, file folder is their 18-page manifesto, handwritten, single-spaced, all that sort of stuff. And so far with this person out there in Butler, we haven't seen that, and we may never see it.
Yeah. Yep.
So I think we can work to be better regardless of if we ever can exactly determine why he did this.
Right.
And, we in the media should not escape scrutiny in this conversation.
Absolutely
and
not.
Some people
yeah.
have been writing in about us. Matt says, rebalance politics, bring back the fairness mm-hmm. doctrine in radio and television. That's sort of the equal amount of airtime for each mm-hmm. side type of idea. Mm. Then Douglas in Cinnaminson, New Jersey says, the media is responsible for the lack of unity in our country. The media does not act as honest brokers and assist to create and exploit fissures in our society. And Douglas goes on to note that Douglas, you know, listens to NPR and reads the AP, CNN, Fox, Breaking Points, all types of news outlets, and sees the same thing in all of those spaces. Eddie Glaude Jr., the media, are we the problem?
Yeah. Well, we're part of it. I mean, look, you know, the Fourth Estate is absolutely essential to the functioning of a healthy democracy. And when the Fourth Estate has been captured by, you know, basic bottom line or corporate interest, or captured by a kind of crossfire approach,
yeah,
right? That is, you know, we just got to have the opinions of opposing sides, and that somehow constitutes objectivity, and not in be engaged in an ongoing search for the truth and the facts of the matter that should inform how we develop our opinions, then the Fourth Estate can become a problem. And plus, we have to understand, I mentioned it, it's a kind of abstract formulation, but there's this fragmentation of ecosystems. People aren't getting their news just from mainstream media. They're getting it from online sources that are not necessarily sources that could be trustworthy. They're finding places that in some ways echo their prejudices and their assumptions. They're in like-minded spaces. So it becomes very difficult to acquire information, to engage in the kind of debate where you could be persuaded to think otherwise, right? And I think that's really important, because if citizens don't have the requisite information to engage in informed decision making, then they can't engage in self-governance. Then that means democracy itself is in jeopardy. So not only do we have a gerrymandered House, not only do we have an undemocratic and broken Senate, not only do we have a captured Supreme Court, not only do we have an imperial presidency, we also have the very space, the public sphere, right, in so many ways, affected by these dynamics impacting the very ways in which citizens engage each other. So we're at a crisis point in our democracy right now, and we need to ask ourselves some hard questions and look at ourselves honestly so that we can actually answer the question, how did we get here?
If there is one thing that your listeners can do today to help with this issue, it's to make sure they go out of their way to diversify their media sources, mm-hmm. right?
And we talked earlier from a caller. We have to go to break, but a caller said diversify your life experiences too. So we're going to talk more about this. You just heard Christopher Nicholas. You also heard from Eddie Glaude Jr. And we're going to talk more about this question of can we, should we unify the country on Studio 2. Email us studio2@whyy.org. We will be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. We're going to continue our conversation now about American politics. With us are Eddie Glaude Jr., James S. McDonald, Distinguished Professor at Princeton, and author of We Are the Leaders We Have Been Looking For. We also have Christopher Nicholas, longtime GOP consultant and author of the Pennsylvania Political Digest newsletter. Today, talking about our big question, how do we bring the country back together? Call us 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org.
And thanks for everybody who's been reaching out. And now we want to bring in Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Ellie Rushing, who has been following the investigation into Saturday's assassination attempt of former President Trump. She just returned from Butler, Pennsylvania, where she was reporting on how the town is coping with all the national spotlight. Ellie, welcome back to Studio 2.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, so you were in Butler, Pennsylvania, Ellie, and I just want you to give folks a sense of your on-the-ground experience. Who did you talk to? What did you take away from the place?
Sure. So I spent all day Sunday kind of driving through Butler County and going south of Pittsburgh to where the gunman was from. Butler County, you know, to give a sense of where the shooting happened, Butler County is just north of Pittsburgh. It's a county of about 190,000 people, 95% white, a lot of farmers, a lot of people who hunt. Gun ownership is a big part of life there. It's pretty rural. And where the gunman is from is actually south of Pittsburgh, and that's just this kind of a small suburb. He was born and raised there, and so kind of He drove north to Butler, where the shooting happened.
Wow. And what has sort of been the reaction of the town? I mean, this is something that's very unusual. Seems like it's a small county, you know, not used to, you know, all the reporters, all the cameras, and just all the scrutiny. What has been the local reaction on the ground?
Absolutely. So the city of Butler is... you know, it's about 13,000 people, and where the shooting actually happened is just outside city limits, but in Butler Township. But they all kind of consider themselves one, and so the city itself, it's kind of nestled on the banks of a river. It's this blue collar town built on steel, pretty quiet place, right? I talked with Mayor Bob Gandoy. He said, you know, being mayor of this small town, it's not even always considered a full time job. You know, he kind of considers himself this glorified volunteer. He doesn't always have to come into the office every day, just takes calls and does some paperwork. This town, though, has been just thrust into this national spotlight that it has never experienced before. The mayor's phone hasn't stopped ringing. They are inundated with emails, people from the city, you know, calling and emailing and some thanking them for their work and with law enforcement, keeping Donald Trump safe. Others criticizing them for, you know, blaming them for what happened. And so it's kind of just everyone there is in shock. You know, they know that, you know, now Butler will be in the history books alongside all these other cities where political violence has taken place. And this is just not a part of what life usually looks like for them.
Anything surprise you about Butler, about Butler County, when you spent the day out there, Ellie?
You know, I think that life in Butler, it mirrors a lot of other kind of small American town lives. Talking with people, they said that life, you know, isn't always easy. That after, you know, again, it was built on steel, and after that industry really fell apart and left, there's still one steel plant in the city. But that, you know, people need jobs. People, you know, a lot of people have really struggled with addiction after the opioid crisis. And so, you know, there was kind of this feeling among some of the residents of Butler, many of whom, like, I think it was about a third, make less than $25,000 a year. You know, in some ways they were like, could this national attention bring us more resources? Will people see the help that Butler and other small towns like it need with mental health and support and just kind of helping people get back on their feet with better jobs? So that was something that did surprise me and that I found interesting.
Wow. And Ellie, as we wrapped up, anything, did you learn anything more about the shooter? You know, the young man Crooks, did you learn anything about Matthew Crooks while you were there? Did you talk to any of his friends or any neighbors in that area?
So again, Crooks is from a quiet suburb just south of Pittsburgh. I drove through his neighborhood. Police and law enforcement had shut down all the surrounding blocks, probably within like five blocks of his house, as they investigated. Speaking with his classmates, my colleagues and I, you know, they said he didn't stand out. One person told national reporters that he was pretty relentlessly bullied, but two classmates that my colleagues spoke with said that wasn't necessarily the case, that he was pretty quiet, friendly. He won an academic award for math and science. He graduated from the neighborhood high school in 2022. One student in his American history class said that he was always, always very much expressed conservative views in class, and recalled this class activity where the teacher kind of split people up into two sides to share their opinion. And he, very staunchly stood on the conservative side by himself, and he was always comfortable with that. Mm. I think law enforcement has said that, was found that he used his father's gun in the shooting, a gun that was used or that was purchased 11 years ago. And so that's part of the investigation of did his father know that he took this gun? So there's a lot that we still don't know about him, and that just remains kind of confusing as to what led him to do something like this if he was, in fact, conservative.
Yeah. Well, you just heard there from Ellie Rushing, reporter at The Inquirer, just spent the day out in western Pennsylvania. Thanks for that on-the-ground perspective, Ellie.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I want to bring back in Christopher Nicholas now. Because, look, a lot of our folks are emailing and kind of saying that the starting point of this devolution is Trump, is the Republican Party. Jen says it's in the Republicans' best interest to keep us divided. They're the grievance party. Jeff says Trump is certainly a major player in the cultural social problems of the last 8 years. Just look at the language and political front yard signs. F-bombs are now okay. And I don't know where the email went, but someone kind of chastised me for saying give them the benefit of the doubt. I don't remember if I said that exactly, but, come on, Avi. What are you looking at here? Christopher, you've worked in Republican politics. You know a lot of Republican politicians. A lot of folks really feel like this starts on the right side of the aisle, this tilt in rhetoric. What do you say?
Well, I agree that Trump has brought populism back into vogue on the Republican side, and both parties have gone farther away from the center. We really do have a disappearing center. I just want to get back real quick to what I was saying before the break.
Yeah.
Go out of your way to diversify your media
consumption,
intake and consumption. Listen and read people who you don't agree with. I find I learn a lot doing that, and it's not just a way for me to learn what the other side is thinking politically. It's just a good way to, find how other folks look at life, because no one has, no one owns their own kind of thinking. It's a big, diverse country. As the old saying goes, there's a million stories in the big city. So, I really think the low point was the 2016 race between Clinton and Trump. I think the 2020 race was not as bad. 2024 here, we've had, as I started this conversation with, all these hard resets that even one of them would have seemed to have been a big thing back in the day. And now it's just kind of common stance. Like I said, we're all kind of, a little punch drunk. So, look, I agree both sides need to start talking more about solutions, spend less time demonizing other people, and more time telling citizens, like all of us, what we need to do to make things better, because we need to be active participants in our own democracy.
And I want to read this email from Leah, who says we would have to take on, this is one of the solutions, we would have to take on misinformation on social media. So many leftists I knew claimed within minutes that the assassination attempt was staged. The problem here is both sides use this kind of warfare now, which started with Trump. Denial of basic facts is creating wingnuts. And this goes to my question for you, Eddie, because, I remember, many Trump supporters believed the big lie and said, the 2020 election was stolen. And now, within hours, of this assassination attempt, many Biden supporters or liberal folks are saying, it didn't happen. This was all staged for political points. You know, so sort of how do we bridge these folks? Because you got folks on both sides, and polls even show that I think like 1 in 5 or something Biden supporters think that this was somehow staged and intentional. Sort of how do we sort of bridge those fringy ideas on both sides of the aisle, Eddie?
Well, I don't know. I think part of what we have to do is just be as assertive and as forceful around the facts and truth as we can possibly be. You know, we are, again, in this kind of fragmented information space. It's very difficult to kind of imagine what the solution will be in terms of how people's ideas are developed and then reinforced by the communities that they're in. We have to figure out ways for our spaces where everybody kind of comes together and they're kind of grabbing for information in some ways. You know, it used to be Bronkite, you know, it used to be the news hour, right?
Yeah,
In my dad's time or my mom's time, they're going to watch Tom Brokaw. They're going to watch Cronkite, those sorts of things, right? That doesn't happen anymore. So, and we can't be nostalgic about it. We just need to understand our current moment. But I want to say something in response, if you allow me, just really quickly to what Christopher said about the disappearing center. I don't know if that's true. You know, I think there's been a kind of lurch to the right that has shifted the nature of the center. But it's hard for people to think about the equivalence between what is called the far right, right, and what is called the far left. When we think about what's extreme about a position around tuition forgiveness, what's extreme about universal health care, what's extreme about a living wage. You see what I mean? So what's getting described as extreme on the far left and equating it, what we're seeing on the far right, right? It seems to me a false equivalence that's very, very dangerous. Mm. And I think we have to kind of unpack that as we kind of talk about, you know, the disappearing center when we're making certain kinds of claims about the so-called extremes on both sides.
Well, we're running out of time, so I just want to bring in one more caller. This is Mary on line 3. Who has a vision for how we move forward. And I'm hoping maybe we can land the plane with this.
Yes.
Mary, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is for all of us ordinary folks, not the people high up in the political ladder, for us to talk about the vision that we have for our communities and our culture and our nation. I believe that most of us have a very positive vision for how we want things to be. And if we talked more about that and less about what this one isn't doing right and what that one isn't doing right, we would find that we have so much more in common.
Well, I like that hopeful note,
really,
Mary.
Like that.
And can I just ask each of you now as we finish, Christopher, Eddie, real quick. And I'll start with you, Christopher. Are you optimistic about America's future?
Always have been, always will be. The great thing about America is while too many people think our story has been written, every day we are writing it anew. So please get registered to vote. Be active in your community, whether that's politics or your church or temple or something else, a Lions Club or something like that. Make sure you vote. Make sure the members of your family vote.
Eddie Glaude Jr., do you have optimism for America's future? I think we lost Eddie.
I think we lost.
No. I'm sorry. Here we are. I'm never optimistic. I'm hopeful, but it's a blue-soaked hope. I wrote this sentence today to give you a sense of where I am.
Mm-hmm.
It's a question. What happens to the American idea when the future is no longer available to it? Because the past has swallowed everything whole.
Wow. Right.
What happens when we don't and when we can't spy a future? Because we're so inundated with the ugliness of our past that we refuse to acknowledge. It seems to me that if there's going to be, if we're going to be hopeful, we're going to have to be honest with who we are and how we came to be who we are.
All right. Well, that is where we will leave the conversation this hour. That was Eddie Glaude Jr., James S. McDonald, Distinguished Professor at Princeton and author of We Are the Leaders We Have Been Looking For. You also heard from Christopher Nicholas, longtime GOP consultant and author of Pennsylvania Political Digest newsletter. Thanks to both of you for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And we want to take a moment to remember a local basketball legend.
Yeah, I just wanted to end the show today by acknowledging the passing. We learned about it this morning from the Inquirer, acknowledging the passing of Joe Jellybean Bryant, who you may remember, you may not. He played on the Sixers and a few other teams, had a long career in Italy as a basketball player, but then was reinvented in a way as Kobe Bryant's father. He was 69 years old. He is in many ways, him and Kobe, part of the first family of Philadelphia basketball. Yeah. A lot of people don't know this, but Kobe's mom's brother was also a great basketball player, John Cox. You know, John Bryant went to Bartram High School. He went to LaSalle. He played for the Sixers. He was Philly basketball through and through. And of course, through the connection to Kobe, became something much larger, an international figure in some ways. So Joe Jellybean Bryant passed away. We just learned about it today, and sending our thoughts to the Bryant family.
Yes, rest in peace, Joe Jellybean Bryant, and our condolences to the family. And that wraps up our show for today. Thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Al Banks is our engineer for today. Kevin McCrory is the executive producer. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to everyone who wrote in today. Ruth, Susan, Jim, Debbie, Jane, folks we weren't able to get to. We really do appreciate it. And we hope you'll keep writing. Studio 2 at WHYY.org.
If you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat, literally. But don't sweat it, Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over a million industrial-grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.